This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The June 2nd primary election is now history. In many respects, it is a historical election, I guess, because of the fact that we had so many people that decided to vote by mail this time. Let's find out here in Lake County how things went. We'll talk here first with Lake County Democratic Party Chairman Jim Weiser. And as always, Jim, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, simple question, how'd it go? And we'll start out first with just the overall thoughts about how the primary election itself went as far as the candidates are concerned.
Well, as far as the candidates are concerned, it was rather unique and interesting and something that was a challenge, I'd say, because, so many of us, especially here in Lake County, politics is very retail. It's reaching out. It's going door to door. It's going to bingos and fundraisers and endorsement meetings and precinct meetings and house parties and really pressing the flesh and meeting your constituents. And all of a sudden, that was all gone.
Yeah.
And it became virtual, and it was a real sea change, and it was difficult. It was very, very difficult to kind of inspire enthusiasm and get people really into the election due to the primarily the coronavirus. And so it was an entirely different experience. I on our side of the aisle, on the Democratic side, most of the candidates really made unbelievable adjustments to deal with that, and it went well. And the results are indicative of how the people and how the voters reacted to it.
I noticed that maybe not many more, but I did notice a few more yard signs out there for many of the candidates, particularly for the county races this time around.
That's a good point, Chris. And I think that's because it was one of the methods that they could get their message out. Typically, you might not ordinarily have that many yard signs because you've been out. You've been into the communities, and they know who you are, and you don't. But in this particular instance, they couldn't do that. So to compensate for that, I think social media activity on social media was greatly increased. I think that the yard signs, the billboards were greatly increased just to get your name out and let the voters know what office you were running for.
Now, when it came to the actual election day for June 2nd, the polling places all had plenty of protection, as was handed over by the state. So this way, those who did come out to the polls to actually vote in person and did not vote by mail could get out and do so safely because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Did you note any problems or were bad problems at the polling places? First off, because of the coronavirus precautions that were taken, and then secondly, if there are any machine problems, so to speak, out there that came tonight.
We were fortunate. We had more than sufficient PPE, and everybody was trained in that and how to use it and how to appropriately use it. And obviously, we encouraged all voters to wear masks, gloves if they chose to do so, socially distance, and all of that. So that went went very well.
Mm-hmm.
We had very little machine problems. We did have, there's always something, but it was minimal machine issues. A couple of encoder problems. I'm trying to think. There was one polling place, I think it might have been in Dyer, that opened late, and one, I think, in Gary that opened a little bit late. But other than that, we're not aware of any situations like you're seeing in Georgia from yesterday, where people were just waiting for hours and getting turned away. That simply didn't happen. It went quite smoothly, and that's due to the hard work of the election board staff and the training that we provide to every poll worker, inspector, clerk, and judge.
Now that we have to, of course, give a shout out to the election board staff. They worked very hard through all of this, and a lot of what they had to do, of course, was going through all those mail-in ballots before Election Day and getting things kind of lined up. And then, of course, they had to continue that work on for literally days afterward. Did you note any problems or see any problems that came about because of this very unusually heavy vote by mails this time around?
Well, I would consider it, rather than a problem, I'd say it was a significant challenge. But but here's what we did, and this is because we work in a bipartisan effort. You know, we have Republican and Democrat employees up there. We all work together, and we all work just to operate fair, honest, and efficient elections. And several months ahead, we anticipated what was going to happen. So we beefed up, I mean really beefed up, our absentee counting, our absentee counter teams. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had 2 to 3 times as many as we normally have because we knew what the vote by mail was going to, or we felt we knew, or we anticipated what the vote by mail was going to result in. And I think you can see it. We had, and admittedly it took a long time, but I think our counting finally ended at 3:15 Wednesday morning, and we had literally all of those ballots counted and tallied and totaled. That's a remarkable feat. I mean, if you look in, I think it's in Pennsylvania right now, where they're saying it's going to take them 3 or 4 more days, and all of these communities and all of these states that are struggling with it, we got it done in literally almost the same day. We got it done and had the complete unofficial totals by the following morning. So it was kudos to all of them that worked so hard to get that accomplished. And that's why, I mean, that's another reason why, as the chairman, the Democratic chairman, I so strongly believe in voting by mail, particularly under these current conditions, that I truly hope that the state leadership recognizes that and keeps that for the general election.
Well, in fact, I know for sure that State Senator Eddie Melton and State Representative Chris Chung are both going to do their best to lobby with the election officials to make sure that there is no excuse absentee voting. I know this is officially called the vote by mail available for the November election. What's your thoughts as the Democratic Party chairman as to what the November election is likely to look like in light of what happened during the primary?
Well, we anticipate a huge turnout. I mean, we fully expect that there's going to be a major turnout. So we know that we even have to ramp up from the primary to be prepared for it, for the influx of ballots by mail. But I tell you, Chris, it's got to be the way to go. I applaud both Senator Melton and Representative Chung for the stance they took as chairman of the party. I support their position 100%. The vote by mail, given our current situation, because I do not think by any stretch of the imagination, and listening to the experts, that we're anywhere near the end of this coronavirus. I think it's going to linger on. I think we need that option available, and I think thousands of people are going to take advantage of that. So we have to be prepared, and we will be, because we've had this. This was kind of like a training run, you know. We got this experience under our belt. We know how to do it. We know how to handle it. We're just going to have to do it on a larger scale.
Well, Jim Wizier, in a word or so, how do you think things shape up? Are you ready for November?
Oh yeah, we'll be ready. Obviously, because of this experience that we had, we're just going to be that more prepared. So yes, we will be ready for November.
That's Lake County Democratic Party Chairman Jim Wizier. All right, let's turn now to Republican Party Chairman Dan Durnell. And Dan, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
I appreciate you letting me come on board.
Well, give us your assessment first on how you think the June 2nd primary election went here in Lake County for the Republicans.
Well, you know, we have a lot of our races were not contested. You know, we have 4 people that are running for state rep, 1 that is an incumbent, 2 that actually are running for election. They lost their bid last time. That's Hal Slager and Julie Olthoff, and they're looking for a comeback. I believe they have a great opportunity, and then a person that's been involved with our party and now is stepping out and running, and that's for District 12, and that is Tim Wyszynski. So we're looking forward to that. We also have, you know, a person running for recorder, and we're also, you know, again, always looking with caucus people in, you know, throughout, you know, the rest of this month and so on. Yeah, so we're excited. along with that, you have the congressional race. We had great candidates. Mark Leva, a lot of it's because of name recognition. He won again. And he is the person that will be running against Frank Mervan.
Yeah. Now, from the standpoint of how the election itself went, the fact that this was such an unprecedented one as far as the vote by mail was concerned because of the COVID-19 pandemic, what's your assessment of, at least from the Republican side, on how things went in that respect, for the reason that the candidates didn't have the usual way to get out there and meet with the constituents?
So, you know, I'm an elected official also. I hold an office. I'm as county councilman. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's nothing like going door to door. You know, maybe I'm old school, whatever. And I think that shows a little bit of that now, even having rallies. You know, I've had rallies before. And, again, this is based on my experience and what I've done. Social media now is coming more and more prevalent. And I think that had much to do. However, again, looking at name recognition going to the congressional race, he had several candidates doing a lot of social media, and the person with the name recognition won. So I believe rallies going door to door, people getting to know folks, that's still key. And if they're not there, you know, their team going door to door is necessary. So we'll see what happens over the next several months as we have our nominees and the Democrats have their nominees, and see how that goes. Because this is unprecedented. You know, it's evolving. There's no model that we have ever followed that we're having to do things in a different way. So. Yeah, we'll see.
One thing I did note, besides all the additional social media opportunities that candidates were able to take this time around, because they had to, they couldn't do things in person as usual, I seem to see a lot more yard signs out. Did you get any feel of that as well, that more candidates decided to post their signs out there than maybe they might have in the past?
Personally, again, because that's one of the things I watch, are signs. And first and foremost, signs don't vote. But I think I saw this about the same amount of signs out there on both sides, running. Maybe where you live, maybe in the South County, it was more prevalent. I live more in the middle and North County. And I saw about the same amount, actually. Mm-hmm. So, maybe it depended, you know, what area you live in, what region of the county you live in, that there might have been more.
Now let's go down to Election Day itself, June 2nd, with the fact that the polls had to beef things up as far as protection from the possible problems from coronavirus. What's your assessment on how the polling places did this time around? Were they properly prepared to be able to handle those people who did actually want to come in and vote in person and protect them from the virus?
Personally, I'm one of those folks that vote on Election Day. Mm-hmm. I go in. I don't want an absentee vote. I think I might have done that one time because I was actually going to be out of town in Indianapolis or whatever. But I really like to vote on Election Day. From what I saw, you know, just in my polling place, everything looked fine. I mean, you had your hand sanitizers. You had, people were wearing masks. We had some issues in some towns, but they were resolving. We have our deputy election commissioners who are out there. I want to give a shout out to a couple of groups. First and foremost, you know, our Secretary of State was able to send, Connie Lawson was able to send all equipment, any needed, hand sanitizers, masks. We had that. But, you know, our election, staff, election board staff, did an outstanding job. You know, from Leanne Ingerman and Michelle Payment to all the people down in that group. You know, we were done counting for the most part on election night. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, but we were done. And if you look at other counties, they didn't do as well as we did. So I have to, for the assessment, I think we for sure did a very good job.
Now, what's your assessment, speaking of it, for the November election? How do you think things are going to go? And I should probably add, are the Republicans in Lake County ready for it?
Well, we're we're ready for it. We're always ready for it. A good fight. You know, it shouldn't become personal. These are ideals, you know, ways that you want your government to run. And that's what people need to focus on. Of course, we're in a party that we have, we're a little bit smaller than the other party, but we are strong, and the people that we put up are people that I believe have the best interests of the people, not their party in mind. As it relates to getting prepared, sure we are. However, I do want to say, and I think my friend on the other side, the chairman of the Democratic Party, would say the same thing. We don't know what to expect because we've never gone through this, and there is no model on what's going to happen between now and November.
Right.
This pandemic might come out. Of course, we have rioting, and I hope that subsides. We have a lot of things going against us. I know our team, the Republican team, and I'm going to give the whole team of the election board are prepared for whatever comes up, and we'll do the best we can. I just want people to know that everything that we do right now is evolving. Again, we've never done anything like this, and we're trying to use, just best practices to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to vote. In fact, I want to make sure everybody has that opportunity.
Well, Dan, you may or may not believe this, but your colleague Jim Weiser feels the same way too. And everybody's ready for November, and will be a very interesting election to be sure. And we thank you for spending time talking about from the Republican Party side how this primary election went. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Thank you. That's Dan Drill. He is the Lake County Republican Party chairman. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This Memorial Day would be more special for many had the coronavirus not gotten in the way, but the National Geographic magazine is doing their best to observe the holiday, to be sure, with a cover story which is entitled The Last Voices of World War II. Go check out natgeo.com for more information. We have an opportunity to talk to one of the World War II survivors who is going to be highlighted as one of the many that will be in the cover story. Gene Polinsky is a native of New York City. He's a veteran, a Grammy-winning producer, playwright, and actor, and he is a veteran of the World War II conflict, and he is with us to talk about it. And Mr. Polinsky, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
It's been my pleasure. Okay, what can I tell you?
You're 99 years old, and that's an accomplishment certainly in its own right. But tell us first, from where you live there in New York State, how did you end up serving in World War II?
I was in a show, December 7th, 1941, came along. Shows closed immediately. I enlisted immediately thereafter. That's how it happened. December 7th, when we were attacked by the Japanese. But then, of course, we were in World War II. And I was brought up for service eventually. And in early 1942, I was sent to California, sent to Texas, trained as a navigator, became tied up for some unforeseen and still unknown reason in night flying, flew a plane to England, was part of the OSS carpetbagger operation, which served the underground in the occupied countries of Europe, mm-hmm. Which was the service arm of General Wild Bill Donovan, who eventually solves the problem, which had been the problem of what was the worst mistake of the war, which was that the harbor of Antwerp, which was necessary for the Allies to pursue the war into Germany, had been in German hands for 4 years under the Nazi domination of Belgium. And I was one of the, I guess I'm the only surviving member of the crew which flew the last mission, my last mission, which triggered the freedom of the port of Antwerp and the freedom of Belgium 4 weeks later, And I knew none of this because it was all secret, top secret. And I didn't learn any of it until 19 years ago when I was invited to Belgium to participate in a reception. And I found out through the reception what we had accomplished and what we had escaped, because ours was the fourth attempt at a very crucial mission, and three others had been shot down, and for some reason we survived and we made the win. We were successful in the outcome of our mission, and I've been learning more and more about that ever since.
As you were involved in the mission at the time, was it just another mission of many that you had to perform with the team during World War II? And it wasn't until just in recent years, more or less, of the importance of the mission itself?
The importance of the mission, of this particular mission has grown, and every new historian of World War II recognizes that it was the turning point which saved countless lives and countless treasure. Yeah.
Now, once you was released from service after the war ended in 1945, and you got a chance to go back to Broadway, I suppose, and come home to do your work, were there any opportunities over the years after World War II ended to kind of reflect on what had happened? Or I know a lot of veterans just went on, they picked things up from hopefully where they left off, or they created new jobs, new careers, if they had to, and just went on with their lives. And no idea, obviously, since you say that you didn't learn until a few decades ago the importance of the mission that you flew, were there any other colleagues that you recall that kind of realized, well, it was a job well done and a life well spent serving your country?
I'm hearing much in the way of accolades like that at this particular point, but for 50 years since we were a secret outfit, we were told to forget everything, which we promptly did, and went on with our lives, made totally different decisions than were necessary during World War II, and lived as, I guess, regular Americans would do.
Yeah.
I didn't find out anything until the year 2001.
Amazing that, number one, that you did well, that you survived World War II, and you've had a great career on Broadway and in the Grammy producing, producer and playwright and actor as well. And we're glad that you're still with us to tell us the story today as we have come past this Memorial Day. Thank you very much, Gene Polinsky, for being with us to talk about this. And we hope that that your story and all the others that will be highlighted in National Geographic Magazine's cover story this month of June will remind people about the past, that things have changed, true, but life still goes on after the wars that we face. And we thank you for spending time with us to talk about it today here on Lakeshore Public Radio, sir.
You're quite welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Mr. Polinsky and all of the other World War II survivors' stories, The Last Voices of World War II, part of National Geographic Magazine's June cover story. You can always go online to the National Geographic website, natgeo.com, and find it there online and see the stories and the pictures. A lot is there as well. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Summertime. Lots of sun, maybe some unbearable heat. Usually, though, summer jobs. Emphasis on the usually, because this summer a lot of those jobs aren't coming like they usually do. That's next time on Marketplace.
Tune into Marketplace every afternoon at 5:30 here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Well, people may remember more of the reading in the history books about the 1980 flu pandemic. But here in Northwest Indiana, people remember something that's probably just as important, certainly in the history of Northwest Indiana. In June of 1918, in fact, this past day, June 22nd, 1918, was the 102nd anniversary of the tragedy that happened in Northwest Indiana. And with us to talk about it, who spent time and had a chance to talk with the fellow who wrote a book about it some time back, Phil Potempis, with us. We're talking about the Hagenbeck-Wallace circus train accident, and dozens of people were victims in that. First off, Phil, thanks for joining us on the program today.
No, my pleasure, and a big hello to all your listeners.
Well, thanks for that. We'll take that in. We mentioned about the fact that this was a historic point in Northwest Indiana. Tell us a little bit, if you will, first about what the Hagenbeck Wallace Circus was all about, why they used a train, and why this train in particular was such an important part of the story.
Well, you know, it's something that happens and continued really right into just a few years back. Circuses are such a large mass of entertainers, performers, props, and sets, and of course animals. Train travel is the primary mode to get from point A to point B around the country when they were doing their performances, which was the case with this particular circus at the turn of the century. And they had just completed a performance in Michigan City. Hammond was the next stop. So actually, it was such a large, well-renowned circus. I know it doesn't roll off the tongue like a Ringling Brothers or Barnum and Bailey, but it really was quite acclaimed. And it was so large, they actually had two trains. So the first train had gone ahead, and this was the second train that met its fateful moment right there on the fringes of Hammond in that neighborhood that forever marks this tragedy that lives on today.
I know that the Hagenbeck Wallace Circus was probably one of the biggest regional circuses in the country, and then you say, yeah, it doesn't roll off the tongue like the Barnum and Bailey Circus, but it is important. In fact, as I recall in reading this in history, that Red Skelton's father was a clown for the Hagenbeck Wallace Circus, and so there are a lot of people that have been involved in the circus for years in one way or the other, and so it's not surprising that the circus would play such an important role when you figure in 1918 to the entertainment of all kinds of communities, big and small, throughout Northwest Indiana.
I mean, if you think about it, of course we got to go into our time machines, and yes, we have newspapers. Yes, you know, there might be over the fence chatting and visiting, but really these strolling minstrel shows or a circus was a major event for any town or even a large city for entertainment. And this circus, when it rolled into town, folks had a chance to see, you know, the extraordinary feats of performers. They got to see exotic animals that you would only maybe see if you were lucky in a sketch of a picture book, perhaps, but we didn't have any Google or any internet. So, boy, you could be lost in fantasy. So what a tragedy to have something that's meant to be such a highlight and a joyful experience to end in what was, that fiery tragedy at 4 a.m. in the morning on that day when a freight train engineer had fallen asleep, missed the switch of the train track, and so therefore collided with the circus train right there on the edge of Hammond, which was carrying all the performers. And again, I want to make sure that I clarify, because there was always some myths and misconceptions, not the animals. That train had already arrived. They could feed the water and care for those animals. They were fine. But all of the families of performers, because many of these performers did travel in a family troupe. It was family heritage to know acrobatics or clowns. It was something carried on generationally. So whole families died a terrible fate of this fiery inferno as these train cars were engulfed in what was the explosion.
Now, I understand there was quite an investigation that came about after the disaster happened. And tell us a little bit more from what you know in talking with people about this that made it so important to note that this was truly an accident. I mean, the guy who fell asleep, the engineer that fell asleep on the train, couldn't really be blamed. He probably was distraught and probably had to live with that for the rest of his life. But it was something that would happen, and it was not really, I guess, other than maybe fell asleep, I guess, at the switch, so to speak, at the engine. He wasn't really to blame for this, was he?
And, you know, and so many folks also kind of, you know, they're not familiar with train travel today, but when we say switch, you know, there's also the operations that happen inside the train engine, but there's also switches along, you know, the trackway where, again, if something is supposed to be guided another way, or if there's an alert that a train has passed, because there were things such as flag stops. And again, 4 in the morning, fortunately, there were not a lot of bystanders or people that would have been gathered. So they, you know, did not witness anything that could have been so horrific to see literally people burning up in these metal cars that were the sleeping chambers.
What was the situation that this engineer was going through at the time? I understand that he was usually a pretty alert fellow, but he really must have had some problems, and why he fell asleep that day.
You know, this is a part of the story that I'm trying to stretch back my mind to recall, and I know that it it's back there filed with all the other archival notes. Steer me in the right direction, no pun intended. Because I know there was so much coverage in the front of our papers, especially the Hammond Tide. They had front page after front page on this with the investigation, but steer me in the right direction as well as the listeners here for our conversation, Chris.
I think the impression I get in taking a look at some of the information was that I guess that he was on some medication, and he'd been a long, long day that he hadn't gotten much sleep. And he just, that was why I guess in that and probably a number of factors were to blame for this and why he fell asleep at the time.
Well, and you know, and it's the same thing. Here we are 100 centuries later, and it's the same thing we talk about today. Mm-hmm. With today's, you know, be it an engineer or somebody who drives a semi-truck, you've got to have enough sleep. You cannot push the body to the limits. Or when a prescription or a pill says do not operate heavy machinery, you know, because of drowsiness, all of these things could have happened just as easily today as a century ago.
You mentioned about the fact that, of course, there are a lot of families that were together because they were performers in the circus. They were traveling on the train, of course, how they got from one performance stop to another. Tell us about what had happened and you learned in going back through the records in actually what happened at the wreck with I guess, 86 people died in the train wreck. And they died pretty quickly, I understand.
You know, and again, if you think about it, and the description is just horrific. A metal train car that is, you know, engulfed in flames suddenly becomes like a cinder box where it just heats up. And how bad the resulting burns were so incredible that a number of the bodies could not even be identified, which is why the sad final chapter of this is that the resting place for a number of these folks is over in right across the state line in the suburbs of Chicago, because there was a mass grave that was created to recognize. And I'm going to, from one newsman to another, you know, Peru, Indiana, downstate, is still considered kind of one of our circus capitals for the Midwest, because a lot of the performers, trains would winter there because the winter months. And locally, in Wheatfield, Indiana, the parish priest there, Father Paul Cochran, is from Peru originally. He's in Wheatfield now, tiny Wheatfield. But he often talks about what it was like to grow up in Peru and how even the town doctor was also a part-time clown. And when there was a clown funeral, he talks about the tradition. So there's your next radio interview down the road with Father Paul. He'll give you a wonderful scoop about Peru and you know, also the lasting history of our train heritage and circus heritage.
Well, it's too bad that circuses are just part of history now because of COVID-19. It would be nice to have circuses again around to give some kind of entertainment to people that are stuck at home and currently stuck at home, but don't want to travel or are afraid to travel, to be sure. But here again, that's maybe something to think about for the future. And Phil Potepa, thank you very much for spending time going over this historic note, the 102nd anniversary of the great Hagenbeck Wallace Circus Train fire that happened after the train wreck that happened just outside of Hammond. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. And again, enjoy the rest of the day and to your listeners as well.
Thank you very much. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.